Well, today, perhaps more than ever in our lifetime, there's some great confusion and misinformation and outright lies concerning morality. What it is, who gets to define it, and how it bears upon our lives. I've actually had this lesson in my notes for some time, probably a year or so, and just never got around to finding a home for it. And then after this last week, it was like, this is the time when we need to talk about this. The liberal media regularly confuses civil rights with moral issues as if they were interchangeable. This is not true, and it is purposely misleading. That media and those who support it want you to think that it is morally wrong to deny so-called civil rights. Okay? There's a lot of subjectivity in all of that. And I'm not here to expound upon all of that, but let me just say this. Civil rights are often manipulated to mean that as an American citizen, you are entitled to live as you please, and that the Constitution will safeguard and defend this privilege no matter how self-degrading, or even idiotic your decision might be. There is a sense of that prevailing in our country today. I'm not saying everyone's behind it. I'm saying that there is a prevailing sentiment. Furthermore, the Constitution was, and we should say, that was never intended and never should be intended to disregard or overwrite the laws of God, especially laws that dictate moral behavior and our moral responsibility to our Creator. So the Constitution does serve a purpose. It defends our right to practice religion, free speech, peaceful assembly, gun ownership, protection against unlawful seizure, etc., etc. But understand that these rights that we call civil rights are only as good as the government that enforces them. If the government fails, or if the government becomes corrupt, and usually that corruption is through power, then those civil rights also evaporate or morph into something inferior to that. Well, I want you to understand what I said earlier about morality, that morality is not something that is your civil right. And it really doesn't matter what your civil right is or is not, as the country determines it. Morality is already determined by God. And this lesson is to bring us to a greater understanding and awareness of morality, which bears upon all human behavior, regardless of government, regardless of specific legislation, and regardless of your personal circumstances, even your choice of religion. Morality is not something that men can decide because it's already been decided, and therefore men cannot change it. They cannot alter it with man-made laws, and it transcends human jurisdiction. Morality ultimately and necessarily involves God. Whatever God has determined is right or just or fair or appropriate prevails. Men can disagree and can transgress this, but they cannot change the standard. Even those who do not believe in God, those who are self-proclaimed atheists or who do not respect God, unbelievers of any kind or those of pagan religions, even those people are still accountable for their moral behavior regardless of their civil rights. That's the premise upon which we're operating in this lesson today, which is a biblical premise which will be supported also by everything that we're going to cover now. Morality is generally defined, if you look in a contemporary Webster's dictionary like I did, as a conformity to ideals of right human conduct, which is a good definition. Everything about that definition actually agrees with the biblical understanding of morality, as long as what is right means that it is consistent with God's divine nature. And this is extremely important because morality is not based upon social forms or social conventions or social legislation. Morality is defined by basically God's own nature. And inasmuch as God does not change, morality does not change. what was good and just and right 2,000 years ago, or even 3,000 years ago, is still, in God's sight, good and just and right. It will always be that way because God will always be that way. But I want to cite for an example here the Ten Commandments, because so many people talk about that today as when we talk about morality. And what you see in 9 of the Ten Commandments are actions consistent with God's own holy nature. And we call these moral laws, and they are consistent and present in every covenant relationship that God has with men. A covenant with God, then, requires that a person do his best to imitate God, to conform to his holy nature. That is required for entrance into and consistency with that covenant relationship. God does not make covenants with rebels and frauds. You'll notice that over and over in Scripture. And laws concerning human relationships are necessary in order to have a right relationship with God, because nobody can live in fellowship with God who will not respect his fellow man. That is as true today as it was when Moses received these words here in, so many years ago, 3,000 plus years ago. And so here's a breakdown of the Ten Commandments for what it's worth. There's some things about God himself. We worship God alone, no idols, no images, no use of God's name in vain. Then there's some laws about human behavior, which are consistent with God's own holy nature. In other words, honoring your parents, no murder, no adultery, no stealing, no lying, no coveting, is exactly what we would expect of a person who is conforming to God's own holy nature. Because God himself, if he had parents, would honor them, and he himself does not murder, does not commit adultery, does not steal, does not lie, and does not covet. Well, so what we're seeing, really, when we talk about morality, is we're seeing that it has to be, whatever we consider morality or moral in nature, has to be in agreement with and consistent with who God is. Whatever God is moral. And anything that opposes who God is or the nature of God is, by definition, immoral. We'll talk more about immorality here coming up. You notice that the fourth commandment, the Sabbath there, is a different command. It is not a command that defines God's moral nature. It is not based upon who God is. It is based upon what God has done. Okay? And so you look at our Lord's Supper, and Richard has said some very thought-provoking things about the Lord's Supper this morning already. The Lord's Supper is not defining who Christ is, but it rather commemorates what Christ has done. The Lord's Supper serves in the same capacity for us as the Sabbath did for the Israelites. The Sabbath was not given to anyone but the Israelites because they were in a covenant relationship with God, and God said, "This is what I want you to remember about me, what I did for you." And we do the exact same thing with the Lord's Supper. This is only given to Christians. Those who are not Christians are not allowed to partake of this because they are not in a covenant relationship with God. But those of us who are in that covenant relationship remember what was done. So we not only remember through the virtue and the wholesomeness of Christ, who he is, we also remember in this act what he has done. You say, well, then if that's not a moral command to keep the Lord's Supper, then we don't have to keep it, right? Not true. Any law that is given to us is a law of God, and to violate that law is immoral. Because the only way to stand morally before God is to keep his commandments. Again, I'll address some more of that as we go along. I hope that makes sense, though, and I hope that helps to clarify what's going on here. Laws that are ritual, ceremonial, festival in nature, whether it's the Passover or the Lord's Supper, are not moral, but they're still laws to those whom they are given. And transgression of any of God's laws do result in a moral violation. So, all that to say that if you're going to live in a covenant relationship with God, then that requires that you imitate God's own holy and virtuous behavior. And where a person falls short of that, not through practice, but because we're weak and we stumble sometimes, God provides a means of justification by way of blood sacrifice. And that's exactly where we are today. in a covenant relationship with God, if indeed we are Christians, when we fall short, there is a blood sacrifice that has been offered to restore us, to redeem us, and to atone for that inferior behavior on our part. Okay? So there are some things we have to do for that, but also that is given to us for that very reason. The word morality is not actually used in the New Testament. It doesn't have to be, honestly. It's a concept rather than, you know, a word study here. But 9 of the 10 commandments, all 9 of the moral commands of the 10 commandments are repeated for Christians to observe because, of course, they are morals. And whatever is moral, truly moral in nature, and defines the behavior of God or the nature of God, is consistent in every covenant relationship with God. And so it's no surprise to see that. Not only that, but we have Christ held up as an ideal model by which all appropriate Christian behavior is gauged. Turn with me to 1 John chapter 2, and you'll see what I'm talking about exactly. 1 John chapter 2, verse 3, starting in verse 3. John says, "By this we know that we have come to know him if we keep his commandments. The one who says, 'I have come to know him,' and does not keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoever keeps his word, in him the love of God has truly been perfected. By this we know that we are in him. The one who says he abides in him ought himself to walk in the same manner as he walked." There's two things that John brings up here that are absolutely necessary in order to not only enter into, but also maintain a covenant relationship with God. You have to keep the commandments of God. And secondly, you have to walk or behave yourself or conduct yourself in the manner that Christ conducted himself. Not only with the works that he did, as far as good works are concerned, but also with the attitude that he had. That's what it means to walk in this sense. So these are not two separate things, but really speak to the same standard. Inasmuch as Christ kept God's commandments perfectly, he was a law keeper, that is, he was also the embodiment of God's laws. So we're not saying, well, you need to keep the laws of God and separately follow Christ. If you're keeping the laws of God, then you must follow Christ. And if you are following Christ, then it must be that you're keeping the laws of God, because you can't separate these two things. They are one in the same as far as we are concerned. Conforming to Christ necessarily means conforming to God's laws. Both of those reach the same conclusion. And inasmuch as Christ is a divine personage, a member of the Godhood, conformity to him is conformity to God. Someone might ask, well, what does God expect of me? And we can point to Christ and say, basically, live like he lived. That's the best answer that we can give there. His virtue, his exemplary conduct, that is what we are to imitate. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1, it says that we're to imitate God. And someone might go, well, how in the world am I supposed to do that? Imitate God himself. Well, imitate Christ and you imitate God. In other words, conform to Christ's virtuous behavior. And really what we're saying is to his morality, and you are conforming to God's behavior, or in essence, to God's morality. What we're saying in all of that is that morality or right behavior is that which is determined by God and his Son, not by men. And that appeals to what we said in class this morning, a transcendent standard, a standard that is above us all, that we all subscribe to, or ideally should be subscribing to, and all appeal to all the time. It's not an earthly standard. In James chapter 3, I'm not going to go there for time's sake, but he does kind of talk about this concept here of wisdom and behavior. If it is of God, well, then it had to come from God. Because that which is virtuous and wholesome and wise and so on comes from above. But if it came from below, well, then it's jealousy and self-ambition and disorder that we should expect to see, which is exactly what we do see. In other words, if it originates with men in our carnal, self-serving, satanic desires, well, then we should expect to see that kind of behavior that is consistent with that, and we do. But when we act godly, or when we act truly in a Christian way, we didn't get that from ourselves. We didn't learn that from ourselves. We were taught that. And where were we taught that from? Well, ideally, we were taught that by Christ, or by the Word of Christ, which led us back to Christ himself. You see what I'm getting at here? It's not among men to determine their own morality, because morality has already been determined. Man's decision is not to define or recreate morality. That's not our place. Our only decision is either to conform to morality or abandon it altogether. And whatever we create in that absence, you can call it morality if you want to, but it's something different. If you take God out of the picture, the entire concept of morality becomes subjective. It is what you want it to be. And that's what we mean by subjective. And also by subjective, we often imply emotional. It's not only what you want it to be, but you have a passionate, vested interest in it emotionally. And this is why it makes it so hard for us to discuss morality with people who are emotional about their whatever they want to do. Because you're not just simply saying, hey, let's have a logical discussion on what's right and wrong. You're actually going into their head, so to speak, and saying what you've chosen to believe in, even though you passionately want to defend that, is right or wrong, and they don't like that. Okay? And when I say they, I mean you too. You don't like that when someone does that to you any more than I do. So there's that to contend with as well. But what I'm saying here, in essence, is that without God, morality is an empty word, and it can be used to justify anything that you want to. Which, by the way, is exactly what we're seeing more and more happening today. Justification for anything anyone wants to do, and then labeling it with morality, or right behavior, or right conduct, or whatever other moniker someone places on that. But the fact is, right and wrong have absolutely no meaning without a fixed, absolute, and authoritative standard. You can't tell me what is wrong until you know exactly what is right. Because if there is no absolute right, then there cannot be a wrong. And if you don't know what's wrong, well, then you can't tell me what's right. You can't come up with your own standard of right and wrong that only works for you but doesn't work for anyone else, because that's called human imagination or your opinion. And life doesn't work that way. And moreover, you cannot determine a universal code of conduct for everyone, whether it's everyone in your community or your state or your nation or the world. You can't come up with that through human imagination or human opinion. Because you, first of all, don't have the authority to do that, and secondly, you cannot enforce it. I want you to think about some big concepts here that we're talking about. And the premises upon which these two different schools of thought are based. One is built upon a God who has authority, who can enforce these things, and so on. The other is based upon the whimsical human imagination, which is going to change every day and every generation. And by the way, is going to steep further and further into a depraved, degrading behavior, as I'll talk about in a few moments. Whereas God is consistent, it will never change, it will always be the same for today, for your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, it will always be there. It is a constant, stable force. In God's world, the right thing to do means what He expects of you as a person who is made in His image. He is justified in doing this or saying this because He is the Creator and you are the created. You need to understand and respect that distinction on either side there. In a godless world, what is right is basically that which is dictated by the loudest and the most powerful. You've heard the expression, might makes right. That's exactly what we're talking about. those with the biggest weapons, those with the most power, those with the most influence get to dictate the laws. In contrast, the wrong thing to do is whatever God prohibits because it is inconsistent with his nature. In a godless world, wrong means whatever is opposed to or threatens those who are in power. You see the difference here? One appeals to a transcendent standard, which is always stable and fixed and has authority to exist. The other appeals to a man-made standard, which doesn't have authority, is not stable, will always morph into something else and degrade along the way, and it really depends on who you ask. Morality ultimately appeals to a perfect, absolute, divine conduct as a model of how people are supposed to live in harmony with heaven and also with each other. Remember the law of Moses, the Ten Commandments? That's really what God was saying. In order to live in harmony with me, there shall be no gods before you, no idols, and you cannot take my name in vain. In order to live in harmony with man, you need to honor your parents, do not murder, do not steal, lie, cheat, and all those other things. And that's exactly what morality provides for us. Conformity to that morality, really God-given morality, leads to the good life, which is fellowship with God and fellowship with God's people. Isn't that where you want to be? In fellowship with God and in fellowship with his people. Someone says, well, what if someone doesn't believe in God or doesn't respect his authority? Well, morality doesn't just vanish or evaporate in that case. That person is still accountable to God. He doesn't become a free agent, you know, like I subscribe to a different morality than yours, but it's just as good. No, it's not. If it's something other than God, it's an inferior belief system, whatever it is. You can call it whatever you want. But you'll be judged by God's system because you should have known better what it is and you had every responsibility to obey it. Those people are not going to be excused. Men who refuse to honor God as God will be judged by God. They knew the right thing to do because God has made it clear to them, but they refused to do so. And when I say disobedient, what we're really implying there is divine punishment as well. God isn't going to just shake his finger at them and say, that's not what I told you to do. Shouldn't have done that. Bad person. He's going to punish them. And however he punishes them, I don't know that exactly, although I do know that you will not like it if you are on the receiving end of that and that it will be your ruin. I want you to compare all that we've just said here. We're appealing to our intelligence as well as biblical support here. In other words, what makes sense as well as what God has revealed to us. Compare that to what we're being fed, say, by the liberal media and special interest groups today. Those who are in power, as well as those who are the loudest, often the whiniest. Okay? Morality is, in essence, what is personally preferential. That is, you have the right to do whatever you want to do, and the Constitution is right there to protect your right to do whatever you want to do. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to note the amazing inconsistency of this kind of thinking. Because this kind of thinking only works when that group of people want it to work. For example, if you were to drive without your seatbelt and you get caught, you're going to get a fine for that. Well, what if you don't want to wear your seatbelt? Don't you have civil rights that say that you can do anything you want? And you're not hurting anybody, are you? By not wearing your seatbelt, you might get killed, but you're not hurting anyone else, right? So why is it that I have to wear my seatbelt even if I didn't want to, but here's what I can do. I can defy my God-ordained function as a man created in God's own image, and I can marry another man and have sex with that man, and the Constitution is going to okay that union and okay that behavior and force everyone else to embrace my behavior as being legitimate. How did that happen? And where in the Constitution does it even say anything about all that? And how does that fall into civil rights, for one? And how does that fall into morality, for another? You see what I'm getting at? There's some real issues with that. So the idea is utopian, in the idea that you can do whatever you want and the government's going to let you do that. First of all, that's baloney. Any of you who have tried to do anything in this town, especially without a permit, know that. And then secondly, it is so completely against everything that we do know, biblically, constitutionally, and intelligently. Secondly, morality is, we're told, that which is socially acceptable. The basic understanding here is that as long as society endorses whatever behavior is being put forward, then this becomes, shall we say, the new morality. Not only is it acceptable, but everyone who disagrees with it, listen up. Everyone who disagrees with this new morality is considered hostile, a criminal, committing a hate crime, and/or part of a hate group, simply because you disagree with it. In other words, when God defines morality, that's open for debate, and we can take and choose as we want to. But when society defines morality, it demands your unquestionable allegiance. Just let that percolate for a while and see where that takes you, okay? And thirdly, morality is that which is legally permissible. Somewhere we got it in our heads that if we legalize something, it becomes morally acceptable, even if those laws that we have just legalized violate God's laws. For example, we're just told that same-sex unions used to be abominable to God and everyone else, but now that they're gaining legal protection, everyone's required to embrace and uphold and honor them as being legitimate. Apparently, we have the idea in our country that we can override God's decrees with impunity. In other words, without any consequence to ourselves. And apparently, our Supreme Court, our U.S. Congress, and our president himself deem themselves more powerful than God himself, in as much as they can change what God has said. That's pretty audacious. I don't want to be in those people's shoes when they stand before God. Modern legislation typically jumps over the moral issue altogether and jumps right to the rights issue. So the question is not, what is the right thing to do in God's eyes? That's not being asked. But rather, it's this question: who can deny the civil rights of these citizens? That's what's being asked. Thus, it assumes that this legal permissibility and entitlement, but it fails to address whether or not the practice is morally acceptable in the first place, or it simply does not care whether it's morally acceptable or not in the first place. Do you think again what's happening in our country? Again, I want to be fair, not everyone believes all this. But the powers that be apparently do believe in this, because they're the ones who are making the decisions that we're seeing plastered over the newspapers every day. The fact is, we have no legitimate right, civil or otherwise, to sin against God or to violate His human nature. If your government says you have that right, you can follow the government if you want to, but in the end, you're not going to stand before your government. You're going to stand before God. Who do you want to be right with? Whatever is called a civil right that violates God's nature automatically is immoral by definition. Which brings us to our section on immorality. Immorality, which literally means not moral, or the state of not being moral, generally refers to any illicit or ungodly or anti-Christ-like behavior. Specifically, in the Bible, in the New Testament, immorality implies illicit sexual activity of any kind. Premarital sex, adultery, incest, pedophilia, sodomy, homosexuality, bestiality, and any such thing. Anything that is inconsistent with the virtuous moral behavior that is expected of God's people, which is consistent with God's own nature. God created man and woman in His image, and He created these two people, really these two genders, to live together in a God-ordained relationship called marriage. It is God, not the courts, who has decided what marriage is and who has given us this privilege. And marriage serves a very specific function. Not only does it allow two people of the opposite sex to live together in a relationship that is legal and wholesome and God-sanctioned, but also it allows for procreation. And that allows for a family to be made, and the family is the basic, fundamental building block of any functional society. I want you to think about this little flowchart I have, which is extremely complex and took me hours to create. I'm just trying to justify what I do. Okay? Marriage leads to procreation, leads to family, leads to functional society. If we corrupt marriage, then what happens to the rest of it? Just think about that. If we corrupt the very first part of the equation, then you can be sure that the rest of it is also going to be corrupted. You might think I'm picking on one certain segment of our society. I'm really not. I'm just broadcasting that because they keep broadcasting it themselves. But if you turn over to Romans chapter 1, and I'm not going to read the whole section again. David already read that for us, and that was sufficient. But I do want to draw your attention in Romans chapter 1, down near the end of the chapter there, really in verse 26 and 27, he actually talks about women exchanging their function and then men exchanging their function, which is really interesting because people go to passages like 1 Corinthians 6 where it actually says homosexuality, and they say, oh, well, homosexuality meant something different in Paul's day than it does today, and it's a different word or something like this. I'm thinking, oh, okay, that's interesting because none of the Bible translators know that, apparently. But then, secondly, you come to here, and Paul doesn't use words that can mean one thing or another. He describes practices. He actually describes the practice. So you can use whatever word you want to, but this practice is what he's talking about. And then he goes on in verse 28 and following. He says, such people do not see fit to acknowledge God, and therefore God gives them over to a depraved mind. And what does that depravity of mind lead to? Verse 29, all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice, gossiping, slandering, being haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, and of course we understand that that's spiritual, moral understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. That's what that leads to. You say, well, which one of these are immoral conducts? They all are. Every one of them. They all fall into the same category. They all defy the divine nature of God Himself. And they all defy a right relationship or fellowship with one's human being, fellow human man. And then he goes on in verse 32, he says, even though they know the ordinance of God, in other words, they know what's right, they just don't want to do it. They not only practice what is wrong, but they give hearty approval. They stand back and applaud those who do these very things. I don't know about you, but I am just so tired of seeing the signs and the banners that talk about pride in something that is morally depraved. And how we as a nation can suddenly show great pride and have admiration for the courage and the honesty and the integrity of such people, when in fact they are violating God's commands, violating God's holy nature, and violating everything that is good and decent, and violating that which leads to a functional society, and we're standing back and applauding this. That doesn't make us any better than them, does it, when we do such things? It's pretty remarkable to see what is happening here. Any union, any sexual behavior that violates the natural order of creation, in other words, how God made us to function in the world that He created, constitutes rebellion against the Creator, no matter what you want to call it. And having abandoned the natural order and the God who gives life to creation, men and women become depraved in their thinking, and they become depraved in their behavior, and the lusting for all that is unholy, that is what they do. And so all those sins that I mentioned there, those are violations of and rebellion against God's holy nature. And yes, then we can go to 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9 and 10, where it says that those who practice such things are called unrighteous, and they will not inherit the kingdom of God. You're saying, well, then you're just against those people because they don't conform to your, you know, standard. Oh, no. It's not me that they have to answer to. Honestly, what I want is for them to come to their senses and repent of that and become Christians. But I'm telling you what we're seeing now is that those people are being called Christians without coming to their senses and without changing their behavior, and so much of the religious world is applauding that. How does that work exactly? What all this means to you? In other words, what are you supposed to do with all this? Well, maybe what I'm going to talk about now is pretty obvious, but I'll say it anyway. Morality is not something you define. It's something already defined for you. You either practice it or you don't. And I should say here, too, that any amount of immorality undermines your morality. In other words, you can't have a little bit of immorality in your life, but the rest of your life is mostly moral. And that makes you, you know, something special in God's sight. No, it doesn't. You're told to get rid of all immorality in your life and not make room for any of it. Do not be deceived. We are supposed to submit to and obey and imitate our Creator, not defy Him and not mock Him by choosing to hold on to a little part of darkness while we claim to be walking in the light. Christians must pursue purity of mind and practice. In other words, purity of what is in our head as well as purity as what we do. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 7, Paul says, God has not called us for the purpose of impurity, but in sanctification. And that applies across the board, sexual or otherwise. 1 John chapter 3, verse 3, John says that everyone who hopes to be glorified with Christ purifies himself just as he is pure. In other words, just as Christ is pure. So there's a consistent and pervasive sense in the New Testament on purity, purity, purity. Why is that? Well, because purity translates to moral behavior. And morality is absolutely essential if you're going to live in a covenant relationship with God. Remember, God does not make covenants with frauds and rebels. If you're going to be a fraud and or a rebel, well, then you can't live in covenant relationship with Him. And regardless of what society says or what lawmakers do or what the government tries to impose or what the Supreme Court decides, we must resist any position that compromises our Christian beliefs. First of all, you have to know what your Christian belief is in order to do that. And then secondly, you have to stand up for that belief. Acts 5:29 will probably be quoted many times in many churches over the next number of decades here, that we must obey God rather than men. It's always been true. It's just more true to us now, perhaps, in some respect, than ever, because now we're having to live that. Right now, this obeying God rather than men may appear to be easy to do. I'm telling you that it is going to get increasingly more difficult in the days to come. And you need to know what you believe and where you stand before the storm comes, not in the midst of it. And even those who practice sin and immorality and deviant behavior may convince themselves that they stand in favor with God, and some so-called Christian religions defend that. We cannot accept that. Now, this doesn't mean we hate such people, because Jesus told us to love our enemies and pray for those people who stand opposed to God. However, it does mean that they, not us, have drawn the line in the sand, and we cannot support their false conclusions, regardless of how humble or God-fearing or virtuous they seem otherwise. And I'm saying that because oftentimes that's what you hear. Oh, well, that same-sex couple, for example, they're such good people, you know, they're such virtuous people, they'll do anything for you. Okay, but what's your point exactly? That doesn't mean they stand right with God, and it doesn't mean they're moral people. Just because they have some good qualities doesn't compensate for what is actually happening in their lives because of their decisions. And I know what's going to be said on that. Well, they are the victims of involuntary sexual orientation, and how dare you, you know, say that about that? Do you realize, just for food for thought here, that the whole concept of involuntary sexual orientation is a fallacy, a fictitious myth that has been plucked out of thin air and made into law? It is not proved scientifically. It is not proved biologically. It is not proved biblically. And yet we are supposed to believe it anyway. Kind of like evolution and those sort of things. You're just supposed to believe it anyway. People who genuinely love God will keep His commandments and walk like Christ does. Because that's what John said in the passage that we read earlier. They will not try to violate God's laws or try to reinterpret them, because commandments need only to be obeyed, not interpreted or modified or adapted to your personal preferences. Morality necessarily involves God. No one can define or enforce a universal code of behavior that serves the best interests of all parties involved unless he has divine power, divine authority, and divine wisdom. And there's only one person or one Godhead that fits that description, and that would not be you or me or our governing powers that be. As our Creator, God alone has the right and the authority to determine what is best for us and how He expects us to live. Christ has provided a living demonstration of what kind of people we are to be if we live in harmony with God. And it is a good thing what He has shown us. James chapter 1, verse 17, every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. Those are the things that come down to us from above. And that includes His laws and His principles, His standards of human behavior. They are all given to us for our good. Not to destroy us, not to simply condemn us and say you're doing it all wrong, but to improve us. And to take us out of the ruinous behavior that we once selected and chose to do, and bring us back and then some into a right behavior with God. Just because people try to redefine morality to accommodate their own beliefs or preferences or even their own lusts does not mean that morality actually changes or that they will not be accountable to God themselves. Those who reject God's authority degrade themselves through self-gratification, through idolatry, through sexual deviancy. In other words, we never see them becoming better people. We see them becoming less like God and more like Satan. You say, well, that's pretty strong. But that's what God's saying, not me. I didn't come up with that. It's not my personal opinion. What good would my personal opinion be in such a subject? Divine wisdom, on the other hand, leads to order, decency, and holiness. Listening to the wisdom of the world leads to disorder, depravity, and all kinds of wicked behavior. What do you want to listen to? What do you want to follow? So those are the only two options you have. This lesson hardly does justice to the subject, but it is hoped that we will all be recentered on what morality is and also what it is not. Not so we can just gain knowledge and walk away with that, but so we can put that good knowledge into action and live in such a manner that honors Christ and rightly represents Him to the rest of the world. Is that what you are doing as a Christian? Are you rightly honoring God and rightly representing Him to the world? That's going to require you to stand up for what you believe. And I'm here to tell you, as so many others have and will, that's not getting easier. It's going to get a lot harder. And I think the coming wave of secularism that is infiltrating our churches is going to start separating the men from the boys. Really what I mean is going to start separating the genuine believers from the wannabes and the church members. Which one are you going to be in? The group of genuine believers or in some other group? I hope that you are making your decision wisely and that you are listening to what God is saying and you're not succumbing to the lies and the indoctrination and the propaganda that's being fed to you by the media all the time. I hope you're reading your Bible and knowing what is said there instead. So much to be said on this subject, not here to exhaust it by any means. I don't know that we could. But if you're subject to our invitation, then that's what this is right now, your invitation. If you need to become a Christian and escape the lust of this world and the depravity of this society and like Peter said, be saved from this perverse generation. If you wish to escape that and come into a right relationship with God, what a wonderful day to do that on. You have opportunity and you have life and you still have time. Or if you've done that once but have recoiled from that responsibility and have not followed through on that, you need to make that right. What a wonderful day to do that, to make it right with God. Whatever your need is, if you need to come forward, do so as we stand and sing the song that Jeff has selected for us.